I'm Laura Murphy-Oates, and this is The Full Story.
Good afternoon. I'm joined by the Minister for Education and the Attorney-General as well, who will be making some announcements on some critical areas.
In response to the outbreak of coronavirus, our government is changing. There's a new decision-making body, and the decisions they've made so far, like our historic stimulus or expanding our welfare system, would have been unthinkable just a few weeks ago.
10 weeks ago, this week, ahead of the rest of the world, Australia listed the coronavirus as a disease with pandemic potential under our Biosecurity Act, following the outbreak of coronavirus in Wuhan, China.
Today, Catherine Murphy on how this crisis has shifted Australian politics. It's Friday, the 3rd of April.
Okay, we are Thunderbirds, go.
Catherine Murphy is the political editor at Guardian Australia.
Ready when you are, kiddo.
Okay, Murph, it's been an enormous few weeks. Welcome back to the pod.
I'm amazed we've been able to get back to the pod, Laura. This is incredible.
Yes.
Let's just give ourselves a moment to pat ourselves on the back for getting back to the pod. Yes. Anyway, pat, on we go.
For you, seeing this crazy couple of weeks, what has been the biggest change in this government? What have you been surprised by?
It's been fascinating in this sense. The government has sort of transformed its identity almost entirely in a matter of weeks.
The short answer to your question is yes, we will keep the budget in surplus. And I can tell you why, because we've brought our budget back to surplus. We're the party and the government that has done that. We were the party that did it when we were last in government as well. And that's why I think Australians can trust us to keep it in surplus.
It's not in surplus now.
I said next year. That's what I said.
And we won't know that until...
That's what I said. I said we brought the budget back to surplus next year. And
well, the last surplus Labor, we've gone from a government that was literally so obsessed with trying to deliver a surplus in line with its election commitments and other things that it was chasing robo-debts from people, and they didn't even stop long enough to check whether the mechanism they were using is lawful.
Which is being launched against the robo-debt system, where an estimated 160,000 errors may have been made. Now, the government itself has admitted, does this need a clean up? And particularly when the recipient of the letter is assumed guilty and has to prove themselves innocent, it's sort of turning the law on its head, and it's a bit unfair.
Well, I don't accept that characterisation, David, and I think some of the things the Labor Party have been saying this have been overstated.
So they were so keen on trying to land that surplus, so embedded in that idea, to racking up one of the biggest debt and deficits that we have seen, certainly in my reporting lifetime. The striking thing about it is there has been very little anxiety about this shape shift. Mm. They've just gone from one identity to the other, as events demand, without sitting around angsting about it, which has been interesting. Perhaps you can think about some Liberal prime ministers in all of our lifetime that may have struggled with this a bit. Like, I can't imagine, for example, Tony Abbott going from one identity to the other without some angst or without some struggle. But Scott Morrison has done it. He's a very pragmatic politician at the end of the day. I don't think ideology is what motivates him. I think he's very interested in the mechanics of politics and power. So in a way, the transformation perhaps has been easier for him than it would be for a more ideological Liberal Prime Minister.
I just want to get into, I suppose, how much money has been given out just in the past month from this government. Can you step us through the types of announcements that we've seen?
I absolutely can. And just before I do that, I'd just say it is really disorienting. These billions start to flow into other billions and you can't quite work out where you are. And
which billion is it this week?
Which billion is it this week? And it's a big, the sort of measure of the day is sort of whether or not we've spent $100 billion anyway, which is kind of remarkable in itself. Mm. So look, there have been three stimulus packages, although the government would query with my terminology there. They would say the first one was a stimulus package and the next two were safety net or survival packages. Now, mm-hmm. The first one, the number one, the kickoff, was $17.6 billion.
This is a substantial package.
in response to a significant economic challenge. The package is designed to support confidence, to encourage investment, and to keep Australians in a job.
And that was a whole lot of stimulatory measures like $750 to hit the shops, support for small businesses to invest, all of that sort of stuff. It was pretty obvious from the moment that that was unveiled that that wouldn't be enough. And so it was, because the government appeared, I'm not even sure if it was a week later, 10 days later, something in that order.
Today, the government is announcing a second package, $66 billion, to cushion the blow to households as a result of the coronavirus and to support businesses.
With another $66 billion. And again, that seemed pretty massive at the time, that $66 billion would now be on the table. But then we had to get to that scene in Crocodile Dundee that everybody will remember. And if you're not old enough to have seen the film, you will have totally seen this as a meme on social media. Dales, trust me, Laura, you're going to know this. That's not a knife. This is a knife, right? Everybody knows that scene.
I only know it from the Simpsons remake, actually. But that's
Exactly. Well, this is why we talk, Dales. It's like you can explain youth to me and I can explain old people's stuff to you.
I'll talk about knifey spoony. You talk about that's not a knife. Well,
and what a knife it was.
Today I announce that we are committing $130 billion over the next 6 months to support the jobs and livelihoods of what we anticipate of being almost 6 million Australians.
This is the $130 billion that the Prime Minister slapped down the other day for wage subsidies. This is for people who are stood down because of the economic shock associated with the coronavirus. They get a flat payment, fortnightly payment, basically, provided their employer qualifies. Now, I know we this is a family show, so we need to be a little bit careful about what we dump on the listeners, but I myself, when $130 billion came out of the Prime Minister's mouth, I flinched, like I physically flinched. I've never stood in the courtyard and had a Prime Minister spend $130 billion in 6 months before. But the reporter standing next to me, whom I won't name, said a very audible swear word shall I say the swear word?
It started. Can you give us a sense?
Yeah. It started in F, ended in K.
Okay.
And it was entirely involuntary, entirely like he didn't mean to launch an expletive in the middle of the courtyard, but it really was quite something.
Can you put that into perspective a little bit for us? Like, how extraordinary is it to announce this type of spending in such a short period of time?
I've not seen this before. Obviously, I was reporting during the global financial crisis and there were stimulus packages launched during that crisis. But this absolutely dwarfs that in terms of the scale of it. And it dwarfs it not because the government's being profligate, not because the government's sort of with the zeal of the convert has now just decided to empty the Commonwealth coffers. It's because of the nature of this crisis. Now, I reckon we'll get into talking about that in a bit, but I'm just foregrounding that. It's because this crisis has some very particular dynamics that warrant this level of spending.
How much does this spending compare to, say, you know, what we might put forward in a budget, what we might spend usually in 6 months, if you can give us a sense of that?
Yeah, sure. Well, look, the wages subsidy, let's just take that one. The wages subsidy, so that $130 billion over 6 months, is bigger than the education and health budgets for a year combined. Mm. So it is massive. It's hard to for people to conceptualise billions because it's sort of, obviously, none of us are going down to the 7-Eleven and laying down $1 billion any day of the week, so it's a bit hard to kind of focus on how big $1 billion is, let alone $130 billion. Mm. But yeah, basically the wages subsidy program, 6 months, is bigger than the health budget and the education budget for 12 months in this country.
So this is a massive shift, especially from a government where we saw radically different messaging on welfare, radically different messaging on stimulus after, you know, we've had a bit of a sluggish economy for such a long time. Can you step us through that transformation? Like, what types of pressures are we seeing to make this happen?
Well, it's sort of quite fascinating if you're a deep nerd, as I am. You know, it was sort of one of the more interesting debates of the last sort of half of last year was this open dialogue that was happening between the Reserve Bank and the government. This is pre-pandemic, right? Like, just all of us, let's just jump back 6 months. So this is before COVID. This debate was happening. The Reserve Bank clearly wanted Scott Morrison and Josh Frydenberg to launch a modest fiscal stimulus package. Because if you can remember that far back, if your mind goes back 6 months, you'll remember that the economy, the Australian economy, was going okay, but there were a lot of weak indicators. And the bank, sitting on the sideline, had launched a number of interest rate cuts over quite a long period of time to try and stimulate the economy. And what happened last year was the Reserve Bank governor basically said to the government publicly on several occasions, look, guys, we have exhausted the capacity of monetary policy, and by that, that's interest rate cuts. We've exhausted the capacity of that to stimulate the economy. We need you guys to step up. We need you guys to do a bit of pump priming in the economy.
But we should not rely on monetary policy alone. We will achieve better outcomes for the society as a whole if the various arms of public policy are all pointing in the same direction.
Now, throughout that period, Scott Morrison and Frydenberg were quite imperious, really. They said very often, look, thanks for your input, fascinating, but we don't think that's necessary. You know, guys, just chill. We've got this, right? So you could concur from that that the government really didn't want to launch stimulus at all. And in fact, not only did they not want to do it, they revved up all the rhetoric about how crazy destructive the Labor Party was during the global financial crisis, right? Mm. The Labor Party stimulated the economy during the GFC. The government characterised all that as being, you know, panicking, being over the top.
Structure, investment program. I mean, we will not be, you know, pushed by some hyperventilating opposition commentators into pursuing Labor policy. That's just not going to happen. We will.
No, but I'm just asking if you don't get the growth that you're expecting to get, you're going to have to do something, right?
Well, we're quietly confident that our plan is working and will continue to work.
And, you know, had consigned the budget to sort of a generation of debt and deficit, and only stupid people did things like that, right? Then, whoosh. In comes the pandemic. Scott Morrison clings for a week or so to the idea that only small things will be needed. It'll be okay. The penny drops for him at some point. This is not going to be okay. In fact, this is going to be diabolical. Then basically it's, you know, it's like that scene. This is the last old person's reference I'll give you, Laura. I just happened to be watching it the other night. Die Hard 2. Where Jeremy Irons drops through the vault, through, you know, they're in the New York Reserve Bank or something. They drop through the vault handily with these massive drills. I don't know how you get them down a street in New York, but anyway, fortunately they came in with these massive drills and just basically dynamited the lot, and out came the gold. Well, that's basically what's happened really over the last 3 weeks in politics.
I feel like that's a reference that crosses the divide. That's a good one.
Die Hard's okay. Crocodile Dundee, no. That's just embarrassing. Mum, go home.
Die Hard in.
Lock yourself up. Just never come out again.
Okay, so we've seen just this radical change. How are they selling it? What type of messaging have we seen from the government to paper over this big shift?
I'd say a couple of things about that. One is that someone, a senior person in a state government said to me through the week, everybody's kind of put the political guns down for this period in time. Everyone has just dialed it down, right? So instead of characterising your political opponents as, you know, bedwetters or panickers or whatever else, the political class, by and large, since the pandemic hit, have just really tried to tone down the politics. And that has enabled the government to sort of make this radical shape shift without everybody kind of just freaking out about that.
And the $17.5 billion package announced a fortnight ago, will those packages pass Parliament today in full?
Yes, they will, Fran. We met with the Prime Minister and Josh Frydenberg and other leaders of the government yesterday. It was a constructive meeting. We've been determined to be constructive.
It is quite disconcerting, obviously, in life, right? If somebody is, you think somebody is a particular type of person, and then all of a sudden they demonstrate to you that they are not that type of person, psychologically that can be a very disorienting experience for people, and so it is with governments, right? But look, I think the government's been assisted by the fact that the case is just obvious and urgent. Mm. And I think the Australian community in a little while will start to be worried about how the hell we're going to pay for all of this. Like, that will happen. That will definitely happen. But right now, I think the Australian community just wants to get through this very serious public health crisis, you know, as best as we can.
We have seen Scott Morrison try to calm those fears, especially around jobs, with this messaging of he's going to save lives and livelihoods. Do you think some of that messaging has been effective to calm the population?
Well, I think it's run a funny kind of curve, hasn't it, this whole experience? There was sort of a race at the start, I think, once people sort of twigged to how serious this was. Lots of people in the community were shouting, lock everything down, lock it all down, lock everything down now, right? And Scott Morrison, entirely reasonably, in my view, has been saying all along, well, yes, we do need to do that, but we need to be cognizant of the impact of that. This is we are dealing with saving lives, but we, in order to save lives, we also have to give people a means of sustaining themselves, right, through this crisis. So there's been this debate between the health measures and the economic measures all the way through. I mean, that's been quite a fascinating conversation. So, yeah, Morrison's trying to frame this, and I think correctly, as in realistically, as in this is what's actually going on. We've got to do a bunch of public health stuff, but we've also got to keep workers connected to their jobs wherever possible. Mm. Because what the literature shows us about economic downturns, about recessions in Australia, that there are a bunch of people who lose their jobs in a recession, in a big downturn, and those people never get a job again. Mm. There are swathes of people, you know, let's just pick a cohort, let's just say blokes over 55 in blue-collar manual jobs. What the previous recessions have shown us is that if those people lose their jobs, they are never employed again. So I think actually, to give the Prime Minister some credit, he's been kind of grappling with that right from the get-go. Mm. And that might have resulted in the government being a bit slow on some of the health stuff, but this is an entirely valid dialogue that Morrison is trying to have.
On a policy level, how has this economic policy at least differed from other governments around the world? Would you say that we have been more progressive? Have we been in the centre? Where would you put us?
Well, I think this is very much a Treasury, an Australian Treasury response to an Australian recession. And by that, there has been an eye to equity, genuinely. There has been an eye to fairness. So there's a sort of there is an underlying Australian ethos associated with these measures. And just one little anecdote, the government with the wages subsidy, for example, they tossed that around in their head for quite a long time before they announced it, because people know Boris Johnson, for example, just came out with a wages subsidy quite quickly. Mm. But in Australia, Morrison and Frydenberg and the Treasury chewed that concept over a lot. And the reason they chewed it over a lot was that they wanted to produce a policy that was fair. And by that, this is what I mean, right? The government didn't want to be in a situation where people on high incomes, so workers who earn a lot, got a higher safety net, a better, more generous safety net than a kid working in a cafe. Right? That did not seem fair to the Treasury or to the government. So they were trying to work out how to give a wages subsidy that would sort of be consistent with the Australian idea of being fair. And that means that rich people don't get more help than poor people if you're talking about a safety net, right? So there's those kind of elements that have informed their thinking. It's going to take us a little while, though, I think, to judge how effective this stimulus, these various waves of stimulus have been. Right now, everyone's just falling over each other to try and get it. And a lot of the money doesn't flow until April or May. So we can't really make informed judgments right now about whether these are good initiatives or not. We're going to need a couple of months really to do that. But that's the thinking behind it.
Right. And surely there's only so much money the government can throw at this problem. Like, how many more billions can we announce going forward?
Well, I think we're going to find out. Yeah. I think we are going to find out. Obviously, the government has to have an eye to being able to afford, on the other side of this crisis, to run a health system, to run an education system, to build roads, to build all those things. So the government just cannot, like, clean out the entire... Yeah, or, well, it's not a matter of cleaning out, because obviously governments can borrow and they can raise as much money as they need. And if they run out of money, they can go to the IMF and ask the IMF for the money. But the thinking is, like, how... You know, this. Let me put it this. There's all these trade-offs, right? In this pandemic, there's all kinds of trade-offs. It's sort of like, you know, if you're in a philosophy class, you'd be talking about utilitarianism. You'd be talking about the greatest good for the greatest many, right? So the government's got to try and make way up. Okay, we spend this now to save lives and livelihoods. We don't worry about what the dollar amount is. We just worry about achieving the policy objective. But at a certain amount of time, all governments around the world are going to have moments where they pause quite significantly, and they think, okay, we've got to not only deal with this crisis, but we've got to deal with the reconstruction effort afterwards, which will be considerable. And also, we've got to return to something like normal functioning in an economy and in a government. So, you know, all of those things will be weighing on their minds, the government, as this pandemic plays out, because we're looking at a long haul here. We're looking, you know, the government keeps talking about 6 months. I think realistically, it's more like 18 months or 2 years.
I mean, is the idea, we had this government so focused on the idea of a surplus, I assume that's in the rear window, out the back. That's long gone.
Giles, maybe your grandchildren will see a surplus. Possibly. Don't know. Hard to know who will actually ever see a surplus in their lifetime. I'm pretty confident I won't. Pretty confident I will not see the budget back in surplus in my lifetime, unless... on the other side of this terrible event, the economies of the world roar back with so much dynamism and so much pent-up demand that the fiscal outlook is not as terrible as it looks right now. But right now, the fiscal outlook is a very long proposition for budget repair, a very, very long haul.
Next, Morrison's communication problems and what comes after the crisis. Money aside and surplus aside, what a lot of people have been talking about is Morrison's communication strategy over the past couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. You've been writing a bit about these late night press conferences. You've been there.
Oh dear. Yes,
what are your observations from being in the room? What have you seen?
Oh God. Well, we can keep this one very simple. Don't have a late night press conference. That's pretty. And look, I'm not just saying this because I'm, you know, on the 16th hour of my working day and I really need to lie down. I'm saying this because on a couple of these occasions, the Prime Minister has looked so exhausted, like just so physically spent, that he is not really projecting the level of steadiness and confidence that is necessary in a crisis like this.
Was there a moment in a press conference where that became particularly clear to you?
Well, I think a couple of them, the late-nighters, he's arrived in a rush. He's just run out of National Cabinet with the agreed list. He's read a list, you know, like a shopping list, you know, peas, we need peas and ice cream and, you know, and 10 beauticians and 38, you know, kind of, and it's you know, boot camp, yes, if it's 10, not if it's 40, yeah, all this sort of stuff, right?
Community and recreation centres, health clubs, fitness centres, yoga.
You know, and a dialogue about, or a soliloquy about, you know, Barre.
Barre, I hope I've pronounced that correct. I might need some help with that. I'm not quite sure what that is, to be honest, but...
You know, it's bar, mate, bar, but, you know, what Barre is, right?
B-A-R-R-E, for those who are looking for the specific definition, and spin facilities, saunas, bathhouses, wellness centres.
I mean, he does it, he hasn't needed to do that. Now, he can just sort of determine what he's going to say, go to bed, wake up the next morning, appear slightly refreshed after his, I don't know, 4 hours sleep that the guy's probably getting at the moment, and communicate those things a bit more clearly rather than be or give this appearance of everything just being a bit of a muddle. And I think they know that, really. I think they are sort of slowly self-correcting on that.
Obviously, behind the scenes, we're seeing something new play out in terms of a whole bunch of health experts and authorities meeting and then the Prime Minister meeting with this new national cabinet, trying to make all of these big level decisions quite quickly. Do you think that that structure is working well at the moment? There's been some fractious situations.
Yeah. They certainly have. Look, and it is kind of scary in a way, like from a sort of governance, civil rights, accountability standpoint, that literally the governance structures for managing this crisis, the nine governments of Australia are basically making up as they go, right? But anyway, and I've ridden a bit of a curve with it myself. At first I thought, oh, this is crazy and it can't hold together because the tiers of governments want and need different things. Mm. And they're basically, there have been some very big fights inside, well, not fights as in ding-dong battles, but real deliberative differences of opinion, right, that the states have had to resolve with the Commonwealth. And I thought for probably a few days, oh, this is just one stupid and two won't hold. But it has held, and I think, on balance, my view about it, even though these governments are doing deeply scary things like not having parliament sits, creating public health directives that allow police enormous intrusion into the ordinary lives of people, things that we need to be very attentive to, right, governments are doing here. But on balance, I think that national cabinet structure has been a really helpful thing in Australia, because what it's done is force the really key debates about this crisis, which, and the key debate is really the health measures versus the economic impact of the health measures, right? That's the key debate. That's the core of it. And this structure has forced that debate out into a semi-public space.
Right, because we've seen Daniel Andrews and Scott Morrison come out with slightly different interpretations of what's going on in this meeting, very different messaging on lockdowns.
Yeah, so I never thought I would say this, but the Federation has saved us in a way. It's like if we were at this point, like New Zealand, although I've got no particular criticism of what's happening elsewhere, in those models of government, of course, there's no states, there's just national leaders who make various diktats, right? They come out and say, this is what's happening. You don't get the debate that we've seen in Australia play out because of the tiers of government, right? And I think actually it's important for citizens to understand these debates, to allow these debates to proceed, and to sort of, I suppose, have the ambition for political leaders to be able to work these things out and strike balances between these two imperatives when warranted.
Okay, so Murph, we have spoken in the past, not that long ago, but it seems very long ago, about how Morrison handled the bushfire crisis this summer. There was a lot of criticism of his leadership style. Do you think that he has learned from that? How is he managing this crisis in comparison to the last one?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting question. It could have a slightly nuanced answer, but look, in a general sense, Morrison throughout this crisis, the pandemic crisis, has really been falling over himself, literally, trying not to screw up. And let's face it, the bushfires was a monumental screw up. And so in this crisis, he has been moving heaven and earth to try and not screw up substantively, and also to project the idea that he is not screwing up. Now, Scott Morrison is never going to sort of, have a deep true confession with the Australian people. Gather around, boys and girls. I'm Scott Morrison. I was an idiot, but now I'm not. That is never going to happen because of the nature of the beast. But implicitly, that's what he's doing with this crisis. He is trying to project to the Australian people, okay, I know I screwed up on the bushfires. I know I did a bad job. I'm trying very hard not to do a bad job here. So that's very important. But then there's just one nuance point I'd flag, Laura, just a quick one. Mm. So in general terms, he's doing better, obviously, than the bushfires. But the measure of how better he's doing can be a little bit shaded, right? If you come at this issue from a health perspective, if health is the only thing you worry about, right? I don't care what happens to the economy. I only care about health. I only care about reducing the body count. Then there is criticism around still that the Commonwealth has moved too slowly on some of these health measures and has had to be dragged there by the states. That criticism is around. But if you look at the debate more holistically, if you feel, as I confess I do, that there is both public health dimension to this and an economic one, you're probably less inclined to criticise Morrison for that. But I just want to be clear for listeners, there is criticism, certainly if you look just through the health lens, that this guy has, you know, been a week late and a bob short.
Mm. I suppose with these radical policy shifts comes changes in our expectations of the government and how society feels about how we should be governed. Do you think that this government is going to be able to revert back to their old way of doing business in 6 months to a year? Is that possible to go back to the ideology that we had?
Yeah, I don't know what exists on the other side of this. I really don't. We know that a big economic shock creates a very significant political realignment on the other side. Mm. We saw that during the Depression in the 20s, 30s and 40s. We saw it again after the global financial crisis, which triggered a massive political realignment around the world. It sort of triggered the rise of populism. It enabled the return of the far right in Europe, and God help them, you know, the American people elected Donald Trump. So things like that do have massive political and societal consequences. I sort of, you know, in the 2 seconds of reflection I have every day, I do think about that a lot. I do think about how we're going to wash up on the other side of this. And it sort of depends, I think, whether I'm feeling pessimistic in that moment or whether I'm feeling optimistic, where I land with that. Mm. Because there's a lot of pessimism around, I'm actually going to just put that in a drawer and not even talk about it. Let's just talk about the optimistic scenario. Mm. The optimistic scenario, I think, out of this, if these people, and by this I mean the political class, if they can just bear not to be dickheads, right? If they can just basically manage this crisis, come out the other side with the same sort of public civic motivation that they are demonstrating now, we do have a genuine opportunity, I think, to reconnect parliaments to their citizens, to rebuild trust in institutions and in politics, and to, I suppose, make the case for government. We've spent, you know, like we've spent several decades basically, you know, in the economic orthodoxy that existed before the global financial crisis, limiting the powers of government, transferring those powers to the market. So governments find themselves at the moment with only limited power and with a trust problem because of the way that governments around the world have conducted themselves in recent decades, right? So this would be my plea as citizen to politicians. Please don't be dickheads. Please understand that at the end of this dreadful crisis, that there is an opportunity to rebuild the entire structure that they work in and to reconnect with communities in meaningful ways. I really hope they'll take that opportunity.
So, Murph, before we let you go, this is the last time we're going to see you on the pod for a little bit. What's going on?
Well, hopefully not COVID-19. Let's touch wood. Hopefully not that. No, I'm just departing the office for a couple of weeks or a few weeks to work on another project. I'm doing a quarterly essay that will deal with some of these life and times that'll be out later in the year. So you can watch out for that in due course. While I'm away in this stint, the lovely Malcolm Farr, who I know many listeners will be familiar with if you watch Insiders or your Political Tragics, you'll know exactly who Malcolm is. Malcolm's coming in for a few weeks to mind the Canberra shop, and you might hear a bit from him over the next little bit.
Awesome, Murph Senior. Thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure, Junior.
Good luck, be well, and wash your hands.
Yes. That's the objective, washing hands all hours.
Okay, that's it for today. Thanks so much to Murph for her time. You can read her reporting and analysis at theguardian.com, but not for the next little while, starting next week. You can one day read her quarterly essay as well. This episode was produced by Ellen Leibeater and Joe Koning. Our executive producers are Miles Martignoni and Gabrielle Jackson. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you on Monday.